From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After 20 years as a cop in New York City, Richard Rosenthal became chief of police in Wellfleet, a small town on Cape Cod. On today's Fresh Air, we compare policing a big city and a small town. Rosenthal is also a writer. His new book, Rookie Cop, is about going undercover in 1969 to infiltrate the extremist militant group, the Jewish Defense League. Also, we'll talk to saxophonist James Carter and hear music from his new CD, Chasin' the Gypsy, which features music by and inspired by Django Reinhardt. And linguist Jeff Nunberg reflects on how our grasp of punctuation has diminished as our sentences have gotten shorter. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After 20 years on the New York City police force, working as an undercover agent, homicide detective, helicopter pilot, and heavy weapons instructor, Richard Rosenthal gave up big city police work. Since 1990, he's been the chief of police in Wellfleet, a beautiful village on Cape Cod, populated with fishermen and people who have given up city life. In the summer, they share their town with vacationers. Rosenthal made another big change in his life. He started to write. He has several published novels and nonfiction books about police work. His new book, Rookie Cop, is a memoir about his first assignment on the NYPD. In 1969, just before he was to be sworn in as a cop, he was told that he would work undercover to infiltrate the Jewish Defense League, the extremist militant group led by Rabbi Meir Kahane that was arming itself against everyone it perceived as enemies of the Jewish people. In order to avoid blowing his cover, Rosenthal had to lie to his friends and tell them that he'd decided not to become a cop. I asked him what he did tell them.
I was fortunate in that I didn't have that many friends in the area. I had just come out of 4 years of military intelligence, having served in the Air Force as a Russian language specialist. I spent about a year at a local school in New Jersey. My parents had moved there from Brooklyn some years earlier. And so when I joined the NYPD, I really didn't know anyone in the New York City area. However, when I was first interviewed for the position of undercover officer, they made it quite clear that I was to tell people I was no longer interested in being a New York City police officer. And in fact, only perhaps half a dozen detectives, my parents, my sister, and my wife, were the only people who knew that I was in fact a police officer in New York City.
What do you think would have happened to you if your cover was blown?
I could have gotten into some real trouble. Understand that when I was out in the field, I did not have any backup. That would not have been possible. My assignment was a deep undercover intelligence gathering assignment. Now, on TV and in the media, you read about police intelligence or undercover officers. What that generally refers to are individuals who go to a police bureau, leave their shield and ID in a drawer, go out, do whatever they're doing, come back, pick up their shield and ID, and then go home for the day. In my case, I was basically on the job 24 hours a day. As I had no police identification, there was no way to know what my job was as a police officer. In fact, my cover was that of a taxi driver and a part-time student at Brooklyn College. But it was a very different kind of intelligence gathering task than most police officers would ever come near.
What were some of the most dangerous things you found out about that the Jewish Defense League was up to?
Well, within 5 months of my entering the organization and through a series of lucky chances and serendipity, they put me in charge of their weapons, and they had over 100 assorted firearms, handguns, rifles, shotguns, plus quite a bit of bomb-making equipment. And when I first became, I was put in charge of their weapons and the training of their personnel, we didn't know how to make bombs. And so I think one of the most dangerous parts of my task was when I hung around these people, when they were fiddling around with the various chemicals, trying to get something to explode, and ultimately, when we succeeded making a viable a couple of explosive devices, I was told by members of the bomb squad that the way they were going about making these devices should have caused them to blow up right there.
Right in your faces.
Yes, and they were these were formidable devices. These were rather large pipes capped at both ends with very powerful chemicals inside. And when we did detonate them, they did some horrific damage to the test objects that we set them off by.
So what was the outcome of your mission?
Well, I was under for about 2 years. And ultimately, I went before a federal grand jury. And a series of indictments came down on the key players within the Jewish Defense League. Arrests were made. And ultimately, for complicated reasons, which I'd be pleased to go into, a deal was struck with the leadership of the JDL. And they surrendered their firearms, their bomb-making equipment, a case of dynamite. I basically disappeared for a few months and then went to the police academy some months after that.
What was it like to become a cop in a uniform after starting your career undercover?
Surrealistic. The undercover assignment was rather special in that I had a tremendous amount of responsibility. I had a very successful mission. I had virtually no oversight. And now I went back into the unwashed masses, as it were, as a police officer. I entered the academy not as a probationary officer because I was well beyond that time frame. So I wore a blue uniform while the probationary officers wore gray. As an aside, another half dozen or so undercovers surfaced at about the same time. And so I was basically going to the academy with members of the Black Panthers, the Students for a Democratic Society, Communist Party, and I believe the Young Lords. It was quite an interesting and eclectic luncheon group we had.
I'm interested in the fact that you retired from the New York City Police, I think it was in 1990, and made the decision to move to a smaller town. You became the chief of police in Wellfleet on Cape Cod.
Yes.
in New England. And it's hard to imagine a bigger shift from, from this huge city with a lot of violence in it to a small town that has a lot of tourists in the summer and vacationers. But it's a small, lovely, quiet, peaceful town for the most part.
Oh, you don't know what's underbelly. No, I'm only kidding. It's very nice. In fact, it was a very deliberate move on my part. I was coming up to my 20th year in the NYPD. I made a conscious decision that I was getting a bit tired of the Machiavellian goings-on at the upper echelons of the NYPD. I wanted to have my own sandbox to play in, if you will. I also wanted to continue my professional writing. So right on my resume, I believe I wrote something to the effect of my goal was to take charge of a low population density police department and continue professional writing. So in fact, I accomplished my goal. It was simply a matter of chance that I secured the position in Wellfleet. I had never been to Cape Cod prior to going for my oral interview there. And I just happened to have stumbled upon one of the most beautiful Cape Cod towns that there are. Which is 65% or 66% of the property of Wellfleet is owned by the National Park Service, so it will stay pristine forever. And we have a lovely bay on one end and the Atlantic Ocean on the other, and it's a lovely, lovely place to be. So both my wife and I are very pleased that this decision was made, and I've been there for almost 11 years now.
How big is the Wellfleet police force that you watch over now?
My year-round size is approximately 13 sworn officers plus a number of dispatchers. And
no, excuse me, I feel like I have to laugh. It's so small.
It's great. I'd run it like a detective squad. My first 12 years in the NYPD, I was a detective, and I was used to how detective squads function. They tended to be less formal, less structured, and it was almost a family relationship. So here I am in an organization that's very much similar to a detective squad in both its size and its responsibilities, because detectives, by and large, have to deal with perceptions of problems, and they've got to placate people. Yes, they do solve crimes. That's one of their functions, but they also have a public relations function. And very much in Wellfleet, what we do is We can't always accomplish a specific goal, but we can make people feel more comfortable that their problems are being addressed, that we'll do the best we can to deal with whatever situation arises. And so I guess you'd have to say that I run my police department very much the way I'm used to a New York City detective squad as being run. A little less formal. My door is always open. Any officer can come in. We can sit down. We can chat. I have regular meetings with people. I listen to ideas, and because I've got some pretty bright guys working for me and women. And it's just a nice, I try to keep it to be a nice atmosphere within the department, because I think that ultimately works its way down to how the officers interact with citizens.
Richard Rosenthal is my guest. He spent 20 years as a cop on the New York City force. And now he's the chief of police in Wellfleet on Cape Cod. He's also an author, and his latest book is called Rookie Cop, Deep Undercover in the Jewish Defense League. And this is about the very first assignment he ever had. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Richard Rosenthal, author of the new memoir, Rookie Cop. In 1990, after 20 years with the NYPD, he became the chief of police in Wellfleet, a small town on Cape Cod in New England. So what are the typical crimes that you see on a daily or weekly basis? And how do they vary during the summer season and during the rest of the year?
In the summer, we have many families come. So we don't have, say, crimes of violence. I've never known of a stranger assault in Wellfleet where a person who didn't know another person either assaulted, mugged, or somehow did something that was so inappropriate as to really raise one's eyebrows. It's quite a safe place to be. Having said that, we have had some situations where we have family matters that have to be dealt with. We'll have neighbor disputes. They can cause all kinds of problems because, frankly, the people live next to each other and it just doesn't go away. And we'll have the more mundane problems of parking matters, skateboarders skateboarding in inappropriate locations. Sometimes children do malicious acts of damage. Nothing much more exciting than that.
Yeah, I'm wondering how the lack of crime affects how people live. I mean, for instance, in New York, you have many bolts on your door. you have, you know, a club on your car and an alarm system. You don't walk around at night if you can avoid it. You know what hours is comparatively safe to take the subway. I mean, in some ways, your whole life is regulated by when it's safe to do certain things and how to do certain things safely. What about in Wellfleet?
Well, we don't lock our house. My car is never locked. I know many people in town don't lock their houses. We have something called a reassurance program where a person who is coming on in age either calls us in the morning. If we can't contact them by 10 o'clock, we go out and see how they are. And I would say about 80% of the homes that we go to are unlocked.
I'm wondering if you feel your opinion about human nature has changed since living in the small town of Wellfleet compared to how you felt about people living in New York City when you were on the police force there?
I find people to be remarkably similar. I find that as a species, we tend to be terribly xenophobic, regrettably tribal. We like to find differences so that we can distinguish one group from another, protect ourselves from the other groups. We're just so resistant to diversity. It's really remarkable. In Wellfleet, though, there seems to be less of that kind of acrimony. Groups tend to function a bit more smoothly together, and it seems to be a pleasant. I think it's a pleasant environment for people to grow up and live in. And frankly, it's idyllic as far as I'm concerned because really, anyone could walk the streets any time of the day or night. They won't be molested by anyone. And it's about as safe a location as you can find in the world.
I want to ask you from your point of view about a controversy that was written up in a Cape Cod newspaper. This was something that happened earlier this year. An African student in Wellfleet was stopped on a bike path, I think for looking suspicious. And he thought that he was being stopped and that he had a gun pointed at him for racist reasons. What's the story from your perspective?
That was a holiday day. I was working that day. I can just tell you the story from my perspective. I was sitting in my office doing some paperwork, and I see a sergeant of mine running out of the office, and happens to be an African-American sergeant. And I asked Frank what he was doing, and he said there was a pursuit going on at the bike path. So I left with Frank. I jumped into my car. Frank jumped into his. He was ahead of me. And Frank took the bike path. I stayed on Route 6, and the officer who first saw this young man was attempting to find him again as the young man had run from him. I ultimately found the young man as he was crossing Route 6, and I challenged him. He just looked at me. I challenged him again. He started coming toward me. I took my gun out when he jammed his hand in his right-hand pocket, which was a very, very bad thing to do. Turns out he had a Walkman on, which I didn't see. Ultimately,
and he was trying to turn the Walkman off?
Yeah, exactly. But I don't know that. I don't have a crystal ball.
Right.
At any rate, according to the officer who did the initial stop, he saw this fellow walking. He'd seen the fellow earlier that day, nothing unusual. But when he saw him walking down the bike path, he had disappeared in an area where we had a series of problems, some burglaries not too much earlier. And he drove his car over there, saw the fellow, asked him to come over, and the fellow basically bolted. The officer attempted to pursue him. The fellow basically circled around, came behind the officer. The officer saw him again and then pursued again. Meanwhile, both the sergeant and I were en route at that point because he was calling in over as a pursuit. So this is one of those situations where the African student thought that he was being picked on because of his color, and the officers believed they were doing their job in ascertaining who this person was, why did he flee from the police, and in fact, flight is an indication that someone is doing something inappropriate or wrong. So it's one of those situations that is very difficult to resolve. Ultimately, I had a series of meetings with the people who this young man was staying with, and in fact, that's even going on as we speak. But
to tell them what?
Well, we discussed the issue. They certainly believed that it was a racial matter. I don't believe it was a racial matter, but frankly, perception is more important than reality these days. So I've invited the woman who the young man is staying with to speak at an upcoming Citizens Police Academy, and that should be happening sometime this September or October, and she can discuss various issues about how police comport themselves with people of color, and it should be an interesting discussion.
Now, this is the kind of misunderstanding that in a large city could really get out of control. And I'm wondering if you think that there's different ways of addressing it in a small town, things that you couldn't do if you were in New York?
Well, I certainly have put in a lot of time on this. And in fact, I learned a great deal because one of the problems that I've discovered after speaking to a fairly large number of African Americans is their perception of how the police interact with them. And I really hadn't given it much thought, frankly. But for instance, the issue of racial profiling, it's less a matter of whether, in fact, it exists or not. But the fact that there's a large population of Americans of color who think that, in fact, it does exist. So the burden, I think, falls on the police to deal with the matter. And one of the points that I make to fellow officers is that we have a very, very large population of middle class and upper middle class people of color in this country, that they're politically powerful, which I think is important, and that they have to be listened to. Not listening to that group would be akin to not listening to a large group of white middle-class people who had some grievance with the police. And it's an issue that has to be addressed. The question is, what's the best way to do it? And I think we're struggling with that question right now.
Is there anything you miss about being a cop in New York City?
I miss, there was quite a bit of adventure there. I did some interesting things. Homicide was an interesting line of work. Robbery squad going after heavily armed robbery teams got the old adrenaline going. And, of course, flying helicopters for the NYPD had its moments. But I think as a trade-off, I'm living a very high quality of life. My wife enjoys it. I enjoy the people that I work with, and I'm not at all sorry that I made that kind of a decision.
Has your physical health changed since moving to Wellfleet from New York?
My wife commented that when I was a homicide detective, we were a fairly busy unit. We weren't the busiest in the Bronx, but perhaps we'd have 75, 80 homicides for the small squad that worked out of our area. And it's amazing what human beings will do to other human beings. And after you've done enough homicide investigation examining crime scenes and seeing enough battered bodies, it does have an impact on you. And I think it caused me to become quite jaded and unemotional. And I think that since coming to Wellfleet, I've since kind of relaxed and not had such a hard shell. I think I've opened up a bit.
Which is hard to do as a cop, probably.
It is, for a whole bunch of reasons. Understand that when we get to the scene of an emergency, the last group of people you want to see upset are your public safety responders, whether they be EMS, fire, or police. There could be mayhem around these people, and you want them to comport themselves in a professional, unhurried, unexcited way. And so you've got to train yourself that regardless of what you're seeing, regardless of who's screaming around you, you must do certain things, and you must do it in a certain order. Anything else, and you're not serving the public. But what it does, it does have an impact on your psyche as a human being.
Well, Richard Rosenthal, thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Richard Rosenthal is the chief of police in Wellfleet on Cape Cod. His new memoir about working undercover with the NYPD is called Rookie Cop, Deep Undercover in the Jewish Defense League. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From Learning Network, providing education-based tools and tips for parents, teachers, and students, online at familyeducation.com. And from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, saxophonist James Carter. We're listening to music from his new CD, Chasing the Gypsy, featuring music composed by and inspired by guitarist Django Reinhardt. And linguist Jeff Nunberg talks about why punctuation means more to him than just the mechanics of writing. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Saxophonist James Carter has been praised for his ability to evoke earlier eras of jazz in his playing. He's been recording since the early 90s, when he was in his early 20s. Before leading his own groups, he played with Lester Bowie and Wynton Marsalis, who discovered Carter when he was still in high school in Detroit. Carter has two new CDs. One features an electric band. The other features music composed by and inspired by the guitarist Django Reinhardt. It's called Chasing the Gypsy. Carter plays bass saxophone on the popular Django Reinhardt composition Nuage. James Carter, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks a lot for having me, Terry.
Now, you play bass saxophone on Nuage. Why don't you describe the bass saxophone, which I have a feeling some of our listeners haven't seen or heard much.
Very important instrument. First off, the bass saxophone is the very first saxophone that was ever made off of Adolph Sax's drawing board. It started with an experiment on the superimposition of the bass clarinet mouthpiece onto a keyed bugle instrument of bass proportions called the Afoclide. And from this, you got saxophonistic sounds without any overtones. And then, of course, with a little finagling and finally patenting it, you get the bass saxophone, circa 1840, but 1846. I feel that a saxophonist really hasn't lived until he's played or at least held a bass saxophone, because it's the mother instrument pretty much. After that horn was made, all the other sizes, 13 in total, were made.
You said a saxophonist hasn't lived until he's held a bass saxophone.
Or
the times,
played.
The times I've seen it played, it's been like wheeled out onto stage. It's so big. I'm not sure if you actually hold it or if it just, like, sits on the ground while you play it.
No, I hold it.
You hold it.
A bass saxophone winds up becoming a machine if it's on a stand, you know, and then you don't have that personal feeling. You don't have the closeness of it, the vibrations of the horn. It's not one with you if it's on a stand. And, of course, certain people can't deal with it from time to time, but, of course, if you can muster up the strength to hold it just like it's alto or tenor, then I think that would be all the better.
Now, you also play the F mezzo saxophone. How does that compare to the more familiar saxophones like tenor and alto and soprano?
The F mezzo saxophone was made by Kahn circa 1928 through 1930, actually. And this saxophone was made to be in competition of the alto and soprano for a lead voice. The quirk of timing that it was made at the onset of the Depression, I think, kind of played into the demise of the instrument. With the Depression, there's, at this time, I guess you're looking at, there's a 1-2 punch that's going on, because swing music was getting ready to come in the form of big bands, so all the instrument companies were pretty much catering to that, meaning that altos, tenors, and baritones were primarily made, and everything else, such as sopranos and basses and other sizes of saxophones, were eventually dropped from production, including this F mezzo. And, of course, along with the Great Depression, they had to buckle down anyway. on what was really selling. So the instrument met a precipitous death. I mean, it was sad that it happened that way. And it wound up becoming the equivalent to a crash test dummy in instrument repair schools.
What's the sound of the mezzo?
It's in between alto and soprano. It's actually a step above alto, and it's very lyrical, almost exotic, very great bebop horn. It has a large throat in it that just speaks all over the place, and it's...
Why don't we hear you playing the F mezzo on Oriental Shuffle, which is another composition by Django Reinhardt. This is from James Carter's new album, Chasing the Gypsy. Saxophonist James Carter from his new CD, Chasing the Gypsy. What era of jazz were you first exposed to?
I actually, my first few albums were from the early 30s, I would say. The Billie Holiday Story, Volume 3, which was on Columbia, represented the mid-30s. 30s to 1942 of Billie Holiday's career, and that got a good chunk of her and the coupling of her and Lester Young together, and I was very heavily influenced by her and Lester and the cohesiveness that they've had in their recordings, and also Duke Ellington's 70th birthday concert, Basie's Jam 3. Those are the first three albums that I had really been exposed to on a more personal basis.
When you heard Billie Holiday with Lester Young, did you hear yourself in the Lester Young part? Is that what you wanted to do?
I heard it all, actually. And, like, for example, Mean to Me, I always thought Mean to Me went the way that Billie Holiday sang it until I heard this Broadway version of it. And I was like, huh? And it just really put into me the feeling and the nuances that she was able to evoke at the drop of a hat, and it just turned me completely out, you know.
Did you know any musicians when you were growing up?
Other than my family? One particular musician that was very key in me finally settling on the saxophone was a boarder that we had in the house by the name of Charles Green. And he had his collection of instruments at his house with us. And at any given time when the family was on another floor or out of the house altogether, I would sneak up and check out his instruments, in particular this gold-plated alto that he had that just looked like it was eye candy personified. I mean, it was just all gold, and it looked like the golden chalice that, you know, woo! So I had, like, several rendezvous with this horn, you know, in private and all, and I was pantomiming like I was playing on it. And finally, on one of these rendezvous, I got caught red-handed with this horn, and by him, actually, and he noticed that I was holding it properly, and so he didn't get entirely mad, but he was like, hey, man, come on. You know. But it wound up being the spark that made him, he helped pick out my first horn. That's what it boiled down to.
So did you have a teacher when you were starting out?
Oh, yes. And I owe it all to him, really. His name's Donald Washington. And if it really wasn't for him, I wouldn't have found out about the joys of saxophone and how I could, just the joys of music in general. And also, he hit me to National Public Radio. So he's hit me to a whole lot of things as far as that goes. And just across the board and how I've been able to apply it to playing the saxophone and just general life.
My guest is saxophonist James Carter. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Carter. He has two new CDs, Layin' in the Cut, which features an electric band, and Chasing the Gypsy, which features music composed by and inspired by Django Reinhardt. Did your teacher share your interest in earlier periods of jazz, or did he try to push you in the direction of more contemporary music?
He shared my interest in everything, in particular jazz, because when I first started in a controlled institutionalized environment, which we're looking at the fifth grade, we had a teacher that was pretty much teaching rudimentary stuff out of a method book, like Mary Had a Little Lamb, High C's Duet, Hot Cross Buns, and all that stuff, you know.
That could be pretty discouraging, don't you think? You're especially excited about this new instrument and you have to play Hot Cross Buns.
Especially for somebody that just the night before was listening to Duke Ellington's 70th birthday concert and went through the whole compass of his instrument. And now has to settle with, all right, the new note today is B. So you're looking at somebody going from playing or at least trying to play anyway and just going all over the horn and then all of a sudden having to come in the following day. It's one heck of a suppression.
Yeah.
So anyway, while I was warming up off of things that I had played the previous night before, there was a sense of discouragement in what I was playing, you know, because it wasn't along with what everybody else was trying to play. Like, everybody else would try and brush up on what was on the page, and I was up there just going, you know, just playing all over the horn on what I had just heard, you know. And this guy was not at all supportive. In fact, he was saying that at the time my reading wasn't so hot, and it's like, oh, you'll never make it, this, that, and the other. And there's this poster that he had up of Blue Lake Fine Arts Camp, which was a music camp in Twin Lake, Michigan. He's saying, oh, you'll never make it there. You know, it's just very discouraging and stuff, you know.
So I know you went to this jazz camp. You ended up teaching at the jazz camp. I think it was when you were in high school, Wynton Marsalis taught a workshop in your school and took an interest in your playing. What did you get out of that workshop?
He came into town to play as soloists with our symphony, the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. And it was decided that he was going to have some extra time. So our high school hosted a citywide get-together for all the fine arts departments in all the schools. And our jazz band was particularly hosting him coming to our school and just having a Q&A with us, you know, with everybody that attended. And I got into talking with him afterwards. And just chewing the fat with him. You know, I've been listening to this, that, and the other. And he sat down to the piano and started playing chords. And I was just telling him what he was playing, you know. Like, he'd go, bling. I was like, okay, that's D minor with flat five. And, you know, bling, that's E flat with such and such inversion. Bling, that's, you know. And he was like, dang, cat got ears, you know. So he was like, play off of this. So he started playing some D minor modal passage, and I started playing along with him, and dug what he heard. We exchanged addresses, and that was it. So later on that year, late November of 85, Wynton's manager calls up Vernon Hammond at the time, and was saying Wynton would like to have you come down for a gig at Blues Alley in December. So I was like, oh, okay, you know, flame on and stuff. And that's how that went down. So I played from that point off and on until summer 87, and that was about it.
One of your other characteristics is that you're a real snazzy dresser. You often wear a hat, or at least used to, when you perform. Some really sharp suits. I mean, for instance, on the Chasing the Gypsy album, you're wearing this really bold black and white plaid suit with really wide lapels, very eye-catching. I'm wondering if you always were a good and flashy dresser, or if that had more to do with your sense of performance, of what kind of image you wanted on stage.
I think, well, actually that came a little later, because when I first started playing, I had, like, decent suits and whatnot. But when it came to when I had to coordinate something, I had some wild combinations that were going on. Even during the time that I was with Wynton, it was like I was kind of hit on stage and all. But started paying attention, had my subscription to GQ and all that, and started catching sales, and just got hip all around, you know. I'd say circa late 86 going into 87, stuff started turning around for me and all, as far as fashion was concerned. And the whole purpose for that, I think, was to just mirror what the music was about, you know. Even if I'm not playing anything, the dress is going to say something. The dress is going to be that statement, like, you know, it's going to be bold, it's going to be whatever, contingent upon my mood is, you know. It could be a tone-on-tone black, a tone-on-tone white, you know, that could just say something about the neutrality in my music or in my life at that particular time. I mean, just like they say, you know, life imitates art, and dress definitely imitates art in this instance, and dress imitates life. It's just a part of the accessories that are needed to get this music across, and to get oneself, help with one's self-esteem. And
what about the hats?
Hats actually started coming along as of after I got my hair together, actually, because there was one particular point where I fell in with what was supposedly popular at the time, and had, like, the Jerry Curl thing and all that stuff going on. Anyway, what days they were and all that, you know.
Well, now that you've made that confession, yeah.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and say that, you know, but thank heavens we got past them, and back to a natural head of hair that can take a hat, as opposed to putting it on top of a Jerry Curl, which would have probably ate it up over a given amount of time, you know, because it certainly did a number on a bunch of my shirts and collars and stuff. I mean, forget it.
What does it do to them?
It just makes them, it renders them useless.
Particularly
if it's it stains them something terrible. I mean, particularly if it's something that's white. Forget it.
Mm-hmm.
You might as well use it as a dust rag or something.
So you got rid of the Jerry curls, cut your hair, and were able to wear hats. Was it also like a nod to Lester Young or Ben Webster?
Um, Oh, it just seemed like maybe a slight nod to them, as far as it seemed like everybody had hats on back in the days. I mean, G-men, gangsters, the whole bit, you know. It wasn't just about musicians having hats on and stuff. I mean, it certainly helped. But it was just being able to, and it was also a rite of passage, I think, in that sense, too. So, yeah, that's what it mostly was, a rite of passage, by being able to have, like, what I would consider to be a big man's hat on and stuff like that, you know, and to finally be able to fill that crown up and to sport that brim. I mean, it's like, whee!
I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your music.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
James Carter has two new CDs, Layin' in the Cut, which features an electric band, and Chasing the Gypsy, which features music composed by and inspired by Django Reinhardt. Coming up, our linguist Jeff Nunberg on the pleasures of great punctuation. This is Fresh Air. Punctuation. We think of it as a topic only a linguist could love. Fresh Air's own linguist, Jeff Nunberg, wants to share his love for great punctuation because punctuation has been getting a raw deal for decades.
I was telling a friend the other day that I was getting bogged down in the middle of the new Philip Roth novel, but that I always give Roth the benefit of the doubt. "What do you see in him?" she asked. I said something about his intelligence and energy, and then, because that sounded kind of vague, I added, "Also, he's a great punctuator." I realized that this puts me solidly in what you could think of as the Stradlaterian school of literary aesthetics. You remember Stradlater, Holden Caulfield's roommate at Prensy Prep. He asks Holden to write an English composition for him and then adds, "Just don't do it too good is all. Don't stick in all the commas and all in the right place." And Holden says to the reader, "That's something that gives me a royal pain. I mean, if you're good at writing compositions and somebody starts talking about commas." It wasn't until years after I read The Catcher in the Rye that it occurred to me how odd it was that Holden should assume that an interest in punctuation was a sign of the literary Philistine, or that the rest of us should so readily agree. But just imagine a composer getting huffy because somebody suggests that the art of musical composition has something to do with putting rests in the right places. How did we get to the point where even our composition handbooks deal with punctuation under the heading of mechanics? One reason why we moderns can take punctuation for granted is that we've shrunk the playing field to the point where the game doesn't seem to be much of a challenge anymore. Our sentences have gotten so short and so simple that punctuation seems to have a lot less work to do in holding them together. The tendency's easy to document. Not long ago, the sociologist Todd Gitlin wrote a piece in The Nation where he reported a study he'd done that showed that the length of the average sentence in novels on the New York Times bestseller list has decreased by more than 25% over the last 60 years, while the average number of punctuation marks per sentence has dropped by more than half. But what should we make of this? Gitlin made no secret of his view when he called his article "The Dumb Down." But that doesn't necessarily follow, and in any event, the tendency isn't limited to popular books. To satisfy my curiosity, I made my own little study, but instead of looking at bestsellers, I looked at the prestigious journal Science. The effect was the same. Over the last 100 years, the average sentence has gotten markedly shorter, and the number of punctuation marks per sentence has decreased by half. But you wouldn't describe that as a dumbdown. At least, I don't know anybody who would say that Science has become an easier read over the past century. Serious fiction is no exception. It's true there are still a lot of writers who are at ease with the complex sentence rhythms of classical fiction. You think particularly of English writers like Salman Rushdie, Martin Amis, or of David Lodge, who turns this ornate syntax on and off at will. But most American writers come to the dinner table holding only a comma and a dash to chop up their thoughts with. And that's not to mention writers like Raymond Carver, who seem to think of sentences as a kind of finger food, that every comma he had a stick in was a small defeat for minimalism. When you mention simplified punctuation, people immediately start to talk about Hemingway. But there's nothing particularly Hemingway-esque about most modern prose fiction, even if it's held together with the same spare set of resources. You can do an astonishing range of voices with nothing but commas and dashes to work with, the deft pirouettes of Laurie Moore, the ambling periods of David Foster Wallace, the jagged riffs of Don DeLillo, or for that matter, the deceptively rambling chatter of J.D. Salinger. Still, I have a weakness for writers who build up their sentences with a full panoply of tools, writers who aren't diffident about occasionally dropping a semicolon into the middle of a parenthetical. That sort of punctuational virtuosity has a particular appeal in a writer like Roth, who manages to do it in first-person narratives that don't evoke the august impersonal rhythms of 19th-century writers like George Eliot or Meredith. For all its complexity, it's a decidedly conversational and modern voice. You have the sense of watching thoughts as they ramify, double back on themselves, break up and come together again. They're like little prose arias, and I sometimes stop to go back and hear them over again. The sentence is the expression of a complete thought. That's what Mr. Painter taught us back in the 9th grade, and I've been noodling it over ever since. You wouldn't think there could be so many different ways of putting thoughts together, so many right places to stick in commas, and so many wrong ones.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Helen Wong. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thank you.